We're Dr. Jim McGregor and Dr. John O'Dowd, and you're watching the Break It Down show.
Yes, indeed. And we're talking about this incredible book right here. Here it is, Two World Wars and Hitler. And basically, it's talking about who was responsible for World War II, World War I, and the external factors that are less traditional in terms of our knowledge of these wars. And so I thank you, fellas, for coming on. It's late over there in Scotland, so I appreciate you staying up late with me to talk about this. What is the genesis of writing a book? Well, first off, about Hitler, that's always a challenging topic, but also taking the alternate approach on, like, hey, how did this thing happen?
Thanks for having us on your show. My pleasure to be on here, Pete. Thank you very much. I think probably the best way to answer that is to go back and just briefly cover my journey in this saga. My grandmother McGregor, her only brother went off to fight in the First World War in 1914, and he was dead within a year at the Battle of Loos in Belgium. He's 19 at the time. Body was never found, blown to bits or sank into the mud, never to be seen again, like so many young men. Terrible. So in 1939, my grandmother's only son, my father, went off to fight in the Second World War. He was 19 at the time as well. And my grandmother, as you can imagine, was very anxious about the whole show. But 2 years earlier, my father had joined the Royal Naval Voluntary Reserve in Glasgow on the River Clyde. There's some ships in the River Clyde training young boys up to be sailors. And that was at a time when fascism was on the rise in Germany and Italy and Spain. So my father went off to war and in the Royal Navy. And in 1942, there was an explosion in his ship down in the boiler room. And he went down with some of his crewmates from up on deck to try and rescue their mates. And he suffered serious lung damage, hot toxic fume lung damage. And his lungs were wrecked. He survived. Six of the men on the ship were killed. So thereafter, my father was evacuated back to Scotland, and he was sent to a war hospital for disabled veterans beside the River Clyde. It was a beautiful, big, stately home that had been converted into a hospital in 1916 to care for men who were badly injured in the First World War, 1916, at the Battle of the Somme. Hundreds of thousands of men were terribly injured. 40,000 casualties in the first day of that battle. Horrendous. So, my father, following this lung injury, my father developed a severe asthma type illness. And from being he was 22 at the time, and from being a very fit, healthy young man, who very keen footballer, he was never able to run or kick a ball again in his life. But he married my mother in 1943, and they were allocated one of the little cottages the hospital built in its beautiful grounds, specially adapted cottages for disabled veterans. And I was born there 4 years later, 1947, and I grew up there. And when I was a boy in the 1950s, I always went into the wards virtually every day to the adjacent hospital to run errands for the men who were badly disabled and couldn't get out of their bed. Some of the men, they were quite old by that time, and when I say old, much younger than I am nowadays, in their 50s and 60s. And they had been in there since 1916. They couldn't go home. Some had no legs. Some had no legs, no arms. Some were blinded, some were totally deaf as well, with shells bursting next to them. So the hospital was run by very, very caring nurses and doctors. And it was funded by the Good People of Scotland is a charitable hospital. So this is where I grew up, in this environment where there were men who had been badly wounded in both the world wars, and that's how my interest initially arose. When I was running all these errands when I was a boy, but when I became a bit older, I eventually went off to Glasgow University to study medicine. During my studies, I continued working as a volunteer in the wards in the hospital. So I kept in touch with all these men and spoke to them every day for hours on end. Few of them, if any, spoke about their experiences in the war. It was something that they just didn't discuss. But what really shocked me speaking to these men is they really didn't have any clear idea of why the First World War had happened. They totally wrecked their lives, but they didn't really know why. So I decided I was going to try and find out about this. And while I was doing my studies, I started buying up history books from all the top professors and history professors from the likes of Oxford University and other elite British universities. And without exception, all of these books told me that Germany was to blame for the First World War. Britain was blameless, and the British men, the men that I knew, had all fought bravely. They were heroes who had fought for freedom and civilization against the German tyrants. And this is the history I soaked in for probably about 15, 20 years. All these men I knew were heroes in my eyes. They were heroes in everyone's eyes in Scotland. And then I started branching out with my reading and taking in some books from American professors, guys like Harry Elmer Barnes, who had a PhD from Columbia University, I think it was, and Sidney B. Fay, who I think was from Yale or Harvard. And these guys painted a different picture from the British historians. These guys were saying, No. These British historians have got this wrong. Britain was as much to blame, if not more so, than Germany. Germany was fitted up in many ways, especially at the Treaty in Versailles in 1919, when the German representatives there actually accepted guilt in the War Guilt Treaty, Article 321, I think it was, saying that Germany was responsible for the war. But what the British books didn't tell us was that these German delegates were actually signing this at the point of a proverbial gun. Germany, if they didn't sign, Germany was going to be absolutely starved. About 1 million between the war's end, the ceasefire in November 1918 and this time at Versailles in June 1919. Over 1 million men, women and children had been starved to death in Germany because the British had continued the naval blockade and all foods. They'd removed half their railway carriages, half their engines, removed all their fishing boats, all their fishing tackle. There was no way food could really get into Germany. And they promised that if the German officials did not sign this treaty accepting guilt, the blockade, the food blockade by the Royal Navy would continue, and Germany would be starved, totally starved, and it would actually be, the German nation would be broken up into small principalities like it had been before unification in 1872. So and these American professors were saying, they were saying this, these guys, these German guys were forced into this at the point of a gun. They weren't allowed lawyers, they weren't allowed any representation at the peace talks at Versailles, nothing. This was a fait accompli they were faced with. So anyway, this obviously caused me to think again and reconsider my views. And for a while I was really quite confused about what was going on, but I was determined to try and find out the truth. if not for myself, for these guys who I knew earlier on. And I was writing to an American historian at this time. We set up quite a friendship and with a regular dialogue with by email. And this fellow, I explained my difficulties and how I was suffering from cognitive dissonance, a sort of psychological turmoil when your brain's hit with two totally conflicting views. And he suggested I read a book called The Anglo-American Establishment. Mm. This book here, I don't know if you can see it. I read this book, it's well thumbed. I must have read it. When I got it about 20 years ago, I read it about three times on the trot. It's packed with information about the war. And it tells us about a secret society set up in Britain in the years before the First World War. I think what I've done is I've just taken... Could I give you a little quote from that book? Because
Jim, you should tell us who wrote the book, who the professor was.
No, I'll come to that, John. So one wintry afternoon, this is what this book writes in its first page. It all sounds very conspiratorial, and probably a lot of people say, oh, that's crazy conspiracy theory. But this is what it wrote. One wintry afternoon in February 1891, three men were engaged in earnest conversation in London. From that conversation were to flow consequences of the greatest importance to the British Empire and to the world as a whole. For these men were organising a secret society that was for more than 50 years to be one of the most important forces in the formulation and execution of British imperial and foreign policy. And it went on to name some of the men. Cecil Rhodes was one of them. I don't know if you know that name. He was a British man, but a very rich diamond mining magnate and gold in South Africa, and made a fortune. He was the guy, actually, that left his money to set up the Rhodes Scholarships at Oxford University. Quite a few well-known Americans went there as scholars, including Bill Clinton. So this guy's telling us, he names the guys and he tells us that King Edward VII, the monarch at the time, was involved with this society, and their goal was to use the vast fortune Rhodes had made and the money. Nathaniel Rothschild, one of arguably the richest man in the world at the time, he was a member of the secret society. Vast amounts of money, and they were going to use this money initially, in the first instance, to bring America back into the fold with Britain, and together they would form what's now called, and was called at the time, the Special Alliance between Britain and the United States, where they would always be close to each other. They would always fight in the same sides in any wars, always support each other in wars. And so that was this book. And as I say, people, the other thing that this guy was saying was, this author, was that these people were so rich, they controlled politics in Britain. They had all these bribed and paid political puppets, basically. And through that, they controlled the politics in Britain. They also controlled the press. They bought up all the major newspapers, and they controlled education, including the writing and the teaching of the history of their own time. So they were able to, through that control, they were able to whitewash, basically, their existence from the historical record. And they controlled this, they controlled education and the teaching of history through the control of Oxford University. It highlights Oxford University continually as the main partners. Let me just, I know people, as I said earlier, people say the guy who wrote this book must be some crazy off the wall conspiracy stuff. Secret societies, want to make war in Germany, want to control the world with America, Anglo-American global control, a new world order. A lot of the things, incidentally, have come to pass. The guy's name was Carol Quigley. And this guy was a Boston Irish Catholic who attended the Boston High School and Harvard University. He did history. He was top student in his year, every year. Summer cum laude graduate. He taught at history. He taught history at Yale after his graduation. Did a PhD and did a master's degree. He's all sorts of postgraduate. This guy was a... And he was headhunted as a fairly young man to be the professor of history at the School of Foreign Services at Georgetown University. Now, this, let me read you some of this guy's credentials. He served on the editorial board of Current History of the Big American Magazine, Big American History Journal. He was a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Anthropological Society, the American Economic Association, and in addition to his university teachings, quickly lectured at the Armed Forces College, the U.S. Armed Forces College, the Brookings Institution, the U.S. Naval Weapons Laboratory, the Naval College, the Foreign Services Institute of the State Department. He was a consultant to the Smithsonian Institute, and he was on the Congressional Select Committee, which set up NASA. In short, this guy, Quigley, who wrote this book, was at the very pinnacle of his academic career in America. One of the top academic historians in America, in the world, in fact. The other thing, excuse me, I'll just take a quick drink. My throat's getting dry, sorry. So he tells us in his book that he could back up everything he said in it with evidence. And he was assisted, he tells us he was assisted by an academic historian from Oxford University. And his name was Sir Alfred Zimmern. And this guy, like Quigley, was no conspiracy theorist. He was a leading British historian, political scientist, and professor of international relations at Oxford University. He was a member of the British Board of Education and the Political Intelligence Department of the Foreign Office. He was a co-founder of the Royal Institute for International Affairs and drafted the blueprint for the League of Nations. Like Quigley, this guy Zimmern, his good friend Zimmern, was at the very pinnacle of the academic career. How he got this information, how Zimmern got this information and passed it quickly, was he had been a member of this secret society. He had been drafted in as a member. It was probably, it started off with maybe 20 or 30 very rich, powerful people. By the time we're now talking about, quickly lists about 120, a close, tight inner circle. Outer circles and helpers and all the rest of it. Zimmern had been right in at the very heart, the inner circle of the secret society. He knew where all the bodies were buried. So that's two of the world's eminent historians are telling us this. And I had followed all the British historians, and I thought our guys were all heroes, and starting at every war memorial and every village and town in Britain. These men died for freedom and civilization against an evil that was Germany, and they're all heroes to man, and now safe in the hands of God. All that stuff. And this, here was me, my mind was getting blown apart with this stuff quickly was telling us. And when I got this book, it took me a while to read because it's packed with information. And I read it, made notes, and as soon as I finished it, I started reading it again, made notes, and then I read it a third time, and I was beginning, then I was beginning to get a grasp of it. And I started looking at every single person that Quigley named in this secret society, this very rich and powerful cabal. And I spent years digging into their backgrounds and what they were doing, and what they were doing at the time of the First World War. And did they have any influence in the war? And to a man, virtually every single one was deeply involved in a conspiracy to cause a war against Germany. And they wanted to do that because Germany by this time was a burgeoning new young country, industrially, commercially, every way. It was blossoming. They were opening colleges everywhere, teaching all the young people science and what have you. And the British and American elites knew that this was going to be potentially a big hurdle to their control, their global control, especially if Germany formed a coalition, formed an alliance with Russia. Because if Russia and Germany got together, there would be an alliance that was all powerful. Britain and America would just fade away, really. This would take control. And that was formula was expounded by a guy called Halford Mackinder in Britain. He was actually an Oxford geographer, and he was considered the father of geopolitics, where geography impinges on politics and especially international relations, depending on the size of the country, its population size, its what resources it's got, whether it's got good ports, whether it's on the river. That's geopolitics for people who might not know that. And that's what we refer to in the book. So I spent years digging into these guys. And I had a friend at that time, Jerry Docherty, who was a graduate from Edinburgh University. I was Glasgow University. I studied at Glasgow. He studied at Edinburgh University. He did degrees in history and economics. And I got together with Jerry and we discussed all this. And he said that it blew his mind. It took him quite a long time to get his head around this, Quigley's work. And when he did, we started working together and cooperating. And we spent years researching the origins of the First World War, the true origins of the First World War, not the origins as proposed by these British historians. And it's far too big a topic to go into to discuss. But one of the products of the work with Jerry was this book, Hidden History, The Secret Origins of the First World War. It's 460 pages. So we wrote that, we could publish it, and it was launched at the Edinburgh International Book Festival in 2013, I think it was. So a sellout audience and a very enthusiastic audience. But tellingly, the mainstream press never covered it. The publisher in Edinburgh, a leading Scottish publisher, had sent copies of the book out to all the main press, newspapers, what have you, but for review copies, for review purposes, not one single review. And our literary agent, he'd been in the business for about 40 years by this time, said, I've never experienced this where a book is so completely blanked. This book was exposing the lies that had been told to the British people about the causes of the First World War. So Jerry and I plodded on with the research, and then three or four years later, we published this book, Prolonging the Agony. And that's nearly 600 pages. And that tells in fine detail and packed with rock-solid evidence how these British elites deliberately extended the First World War beyond 1915, when it could and should have ended. Kaiser Wilhelm in Germany was making repeated efforts to hold peace talks and stop this war, and he was blanked at every turn, So if any of yours might find some of that stuff interesting.
I put a couple links up here for everybody who's listening to what we've started here. So here's the Anglo-American Establishment. That's the book that Jim referenced earlier. And then here's the one he most recently referenced, Hidden History. And of course, hey, these fellas, they've got their book, The Two World Wars and Hitler. There's a whole longer title here. Who was responsible? Anglo-American money, foreign agents, and geopolitics, what we just talked about. So, yeah, when you guys get into this story, obviously there's a ton of research. And I mean, I think about like Stephen Dorrell's MI6 book. I think you guys ever read that thing, but it's so packed with well-credentialed substance books that go into the bibliography. You have to read like 30 books just to understand this book and all the lessons that go into that. That is a monumental piece of work. This book is similarly, I'll pull that book down off my shelf. This thing is huge. So how long did it take you to assemble the thoughts into a cogent story, a message? And then how did you bring in John's work to augment what you guys
did? Yeah. Well, I'd obviously done a lot of research in the First World War, having produced these books. And then I wanted to move on to deeper research into the Second World War, the causes of that, and see if the same secret society had been involved in the genesis of the Second World War and the rise of Hitler. The co-author of the first two books, Jerry, he sadly died. John and I had known each other for a long time, and John's very interested in economics and stuff. And I'll hand you over to John and let him talk about the money side of this and the banks, how they control things.
Yeah. Well, as soon as you say the word Rothschilds, John, you know, my ear goes up and I go, huh?
I don't think MD said the word Rothschild.
Well, no, but it was earlier on.
I mentioned him as a member of the secret society.
Yeah, he was one of a number, but an important one. My background is I'm a scientist. I'm a biochemist. Jim, my father served in the Second World War. He was in the Royal Air Force. He flew in bombers. And after the he joined in 1939. And after the invasion of Normandy of Europe, he was seconded to U.S. land forces. And he crossed Europe with U.S. forces. Wow. And that gave him an abiding love and admiration for all things American, because they were his brothers in arms across some very tough years. He never spoke about it, hardly ever spoke about it, but my mother told me one or two things about how he'd seen some terrible things, and that left him, like Jim's father, with a serious dislike of Nazism and Hitler, and a serious love and admiration for the United States. And we've gone on from that. And I was lucky enough to become a scientist. I went to, like Jim, I went to Glasgow University, and I did a PhD in medical sciences at Glasgow University. And I worked as a lecturer, as an academic, as a researcher, as a scientist. And latterly, I went into research management, and that got me interested in how universities were funded, how the directions of research and the directions of scholarship were slowly but surely becoming dictated by people outside of universities, largely by financial interests. And like Jim, I also had an interest from the fact of my father's background and how these wars happened. And I got to know Jim through our mutual interest in how Bush and Blair got together to have the Iraq War. And we thought there was something a bit smelly about it. And as it turns out, of course, it was based on a whole load of lies about weapons of mass destruction And you start asking yourself, why do people do these things? Why did they sacrifice so many young men and women at that stage in wars which had very little chance of success, which left the place worse than it was, and which seemed to have no rhyme or reason to it? And it started me thinking about that and what was happening in the universities and how certain aspects of funding, etc., were dictated by people who had no real interest in scholarship, no real interest in advancing real human interests. And so I studied economics. I did an MBA, and I got a distinction in economics in that. And I started to look at economics as a science. And I already, by this time, had a considerable track record in actual science and biological sciences and biochemistry. And I knew how science worked. And it struck me as being very strange, because economics didn't work like that. Economics didn't work by looking at investigations of what actually exists and how we can use these to form theories about how the world works, and then use those theories to predict how things might happen if we do this, you know, experimental methods. Economics was a very different thing. It had a whole load of axioms which seemed to have been dreamed up by people sitting at desks using some sort of COD mathematical formulae, and which bore no relation to the real world. You know, in particular, theories of money don't exist in neoclassical economics. Money is not really described. Banking is not touched at all. How banks work. So that got me interested in how banking worked. And banking's a very strange thing. Money is a very strange thing. It doesn't actually exist. It exists right. only as a notion. It exists only as a means of exchange. And it exists as also as a store of value. And there are problematic linkages between the role of money as a means of exchange, which we all need to carry out our daily lives and we all use, and the whole idea of how money is created, how money is used, and how that gives power. Now, the background to that is there was a guy in Scotland called Adam Smith, which some of your listeners might be aware of, and he was of the old classical economics school, which is not economics at all. It was called political economy, and it studied the linkage between power and money. And that seemed to have been dropped by the time economics became. In fact, when I was an undergraduate at Glasgow University, there was still a subject called political economy. There was no such subject as economics. And that changed, and it became economics sometime in the 1980s. And economics is a very different beast from political economy, because whereas political economy looks at how money and power are interlinked, economics doesn't really talk about power, and it doesn't really talk about money, and it doesn't talk at all about banking. And that got me interested in how these things happened. And to cut a long story short, the relationship between banking and this story is that, and it's actually a very interesting part of the story of the United States, where the United States initially had greenbacks and government-issued money, and where money was used simply as a means of exchange, and where down the centuries, from the inception of the United States, when it fought to free itself of kings and of Britain and of all the tyranny of kings, it fought hard to keep itself independent. It did this by keeping the dollar, by keeping its currency independent, by having government-issued currency and not letting the bankers control that. Slowly but surely that was eroded, and that's part of our story, because the Boston Brahmins, who are part of this story as well, were deeply involved in that erosion of America's financial and economic independence. And slowly it insinuated itself into the control of governance through things like the Federal Reserve Act and bringing about the control of the issue of money, which is actually created out of nothing, by fiat, and this was wrested away from the control of the government, because actually in the end only governments can issue currency, only governments can guarantee that currency can be used to pay debts, that it can be used to honor contracts, and that it can be used to pay taxes, which is what links it to the government. And this was taken away, and it was done very quietly and sleekily, as we say in Scotland. underhand way by the creation of the Federal Reserve, which sounds like a government body, but actually isn't. It's a body owned by a cartel of bankers. And they now largely issue money as debt with interest in the US and for the world, because that's the world's reserve currency. And this gives them enormous power. It gives them total power. And some would say that the Republic has been lost. The American have lost the Republic, and through that have slowly lost the democracy as a result of secret cartels of money men actually owning the government or running how the government is, what the government does, who the government is, who your presidents are, who your politicians are, how they get elected, how much it costs to get elected, where the money for their elections come from. And this gives enormous power to these people who control the money, which takes us back to the relationship between money and power. So I started looking at that and looking at the relationship. And by this time, Jim and I had got together, and I was aware of the work Jim was doing on the First World War with Jerry. And I had brought my own background into this about the nature of how we know things, the nature of knowledge, the nature of how it's called epistemology. It's the philosophy of what do we know? How do we know it? How can we show that that is a valid form of knowledge? And we do that in science by making theories, by testing theories. This broke down when we looked at economics. There was no genuine epistemology. So I started to look at history as well, and Jim looked at history even more. And we discovered these things that Carol Quigley had said, and how Carol Quigley fell off his perch to some extent, and actually required that the second book wasn't published until after his death, because he knew what would happen to his reputation and career were he to publish it. And this is what brought us round to thinking about these things and how that kind of money power influences who is in government, what government does, what government is for, how it's divorced from the people, how it's divorced from the people's real interests, and how it can send their sons and daughters off to fight foreign wars in foreign fields, which have no rhyme nor reason to them in the normal life and existence of the people concerned, and how this takes away from the real function of government, which should be to be controlled by the people, government by the people, for the people, responsible to the people, elected by the people, and where power should reside. And that's what got me into this, and it got us to write, got us into writing this book. And we started then to look at how Versailles happened and how that led to the Second World War. And perhaps Jim can tell us a bit more about that at this stage.
But let me jump in here real quick before Jim goes on. When you talk about scientific method, you know, there's three basic forms. I'm going to keep this short for everybody, right? But you're either creating something, validating something, or challenging something. And so when you challenge things, the academic community tends to spit the bit a little bit. They get upset because you're coming after their work. But it's part of the rigor that you have to put into this system, right? Because you have to replicate what you guys are saying, which that's what references are for. And someone can go through and say, hey, you got it all wrong. We don't like it when that happens, though, when someone challenges this norm. I'm with you guys. Like, I know quite a bit about foreign policy from my angle, because I'm on the ground trying to advance it individually when I'm doing my espionage work. I don't do that anymore, but back when I did. And when you do that work and you see the lies, and then the government puts lies into my mouth, I'm a spy complaining about lying here, but when I say, oh, no, this is going to happen. Oh, no, this is going to be good for you. Trust me. And all these lies come out, and I realize that I have been the agent of someone else who had no intention of actually accomplishing this thing. And then you realize at the bigger level that, at least here in America, we tend to pick sides. So there's a whole bunch of PhD academics who want Russia to be broken into 1,000 pieces. Sounds familiar. They are desperate to have this fight with Russia. And now, look, we have this proxy war with Russia going on, where thousands of dudes who have nothing to do with these international things are being run through this grisly war for no damn reason, right? So we have these things. Another thing that America does is they sort of say, here's the line. Anybody on this side of the line, they're good with us. Anybody on that side of the line, they're not aligned with the West. It doesn't matter if that's true or not, but that's what we do. We tend to pick sides and make demons out of people that are simply just business people with interests that don't involve whatever America wants it to be. And so a lot of what you guys are saying resonates with me, because we do have people. It's, and I know you guys will get this, it's all a competition. Every single bit of it, everything is competed for, and then come the results. And so wars happen because of these things, and they get extended because there's a lot of money on the line and people don't want to lose in this way as opposed to losing in that way. Hamas is a good example. If that war was going to end, all Hamas has to do is say, we surrender unconditionally, and that war stops in that instant. But they don't want to do that. They are competing for control over a narrative, over a people, over land, whatever it is. So I appreciate you guys talking about these things at this level, because there are money interests in everything that we do.
Absolutely.
Because there's a competition for resources. And we have this belief that billionaires hoard money. I'm going to hoard my money. But they... that was my best at Irish, not a Scottish accent, by the way. that money never rests, right? Like you said, it's not real. There's not
it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist.
Right. It moves at speed of light.
It only has a money only works when it circulates. It cannot be stored. It cannot be buried. It can't. You can't do anything with it. It's a notion. It's something that exists in people's heads, and it only works when it circulates. If you hoard it, then you do strange things to the economy, to the real economy, the actual, how the real economy works.
But and if you carry too much of it around, you draw the police's attention.
Absolutely.
And I'll
tell
you
what, and I'll tell you how you know, it really is the government that has the ultimate and fundamental control of it. Try printing some yourself and see how far you get with it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But you asked about the scientific method. The scientific method works quite well. You make some observations. You have what's called empirical observations. You see things that do things, and then you study them and you form theories about how that works. Then you test those theories in experiments or by further observation, such as in astronomy. Well, you can't actually do experiments in astronomy, but you can design things that you can observe in the universe, which can either back or destroy your theory. In science, you use the experimental method to do that. In science, you eventually, it is contested. It's always contested because scientific theories are always provisional and they're always up for challenge. And as soon as the evidence emerges which challenges or breaks them down, that theory has to be discarded, right? And you can do that in science. You can do that in the natural sciences because eventually 95% of scientists will agree with most things which is in their field. You go to economics, and as you say, they divide 50-50 down the line. 50% of them agree with that. 50% of them won't, because they don't have the empirical test that you have in genuine sciences and real sciences. And what's more, they're wedded to basically to political philosophies, to economic philosophies, which die hard, which are hard tested and die hard. And people will die in the ditch to defend the philosophy, even in the face of overwhelming evidence that it's wrong. And this is why it's a social science. And for that reason, it does what people do, and they contest things. And we are competing for resources. But there are ways of doing this which are not so destructive as the ways we seem to have devised in our time.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. Yeah, when you mentioned anthropology earlier, I thought, oh boy, it's always a problem with anthropology because a lot of it is guesswork and most likely, and you ask the person, if you put them on the spot, they're like, whoa, hold on. I'm not saying 100% this. This is just what I think, right? And it's educated thing.
It depends who you ask.
Yeah. Well, that's true, too. Yeah. Yeah. And it's not a knock on anthropology.
No, it's not. It's a different methodology. It's a different kind of science. And it's important to understand that there is a valid thing. There's a valid science of economics. And it was extremely valid at one time when it was linked to the political economy. When people who study science understood the power relations.
Yeah.
But now it's been abstracted into these abstract mathematical theories which bear no relation to the real world, and it's used to drive the real world in ways which are not necessarily beneficial to most people, either in your country or on the planet. And that's really where this is where unnecessary wars come from, where this kind of thing drives them, where people are forced into fighting wars that ought not to have been fought, which were fomented, as we claim in this book, solely for the geopolitical purposes of the people who own this notional thing called money. And what they actually own is power, because there is no such thing as money. There are people who hold power by virtue of the fact that they control governments and they can control those who control governments. And they, in this case, they originally didn't want Germany to get strong, and then they didn't want Russia to get strong because they didn't want any Eurasian-based powers to be in a position to control Eurasia. So Britain and American elites decided that the way they would do that was to get Germany and Russia to fight it out to the death. And they did that in a 100 years' wars from 1914 to 1944, and probably right to this date, because as you mentioned, you can see the same thing happening with the proxy war in Ukraine and the whole of the NATO thing about trying to break up Russia. And if you read Zbigniew Brzezinski's The Grand Chessboard, he's quite frank about what these aims are. And they're the same aims. He cites Halford Mackinder and he says, this is Mackinder's plan. It's our plan too. We want to atomize Russia because we want to control Eurasia.
There's also a lot of investment in personal success in the academic world. We have, critical of the academics you write about, and they foment a war with Russia because that's what their PhD is written in. And so they can't have this future that they've predicted not come true, because that's where their expertise is, right? And so they're desperate for it. They write think tank papers. And by the way, you were talking about money, and I know you've looked into this. Who's funding these think tanks? Oh, well, shit.
Now it's a billionaire. It's a billionaire in the bankers. Yeah.
Pete? I'm a bit wary of time. How are we doing for time here?
We got about another 10 minutes, 20, 10 like minutes. 15 minutes tops.
If it's okay with you, I'd just very quickly like to discuss one of the major points in our book, because it is totally mind-blowing. Totally mind-blowing.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's get our minds blown.
Yeah. As well as the banks funding Hitler and the Nazis, that's now well documented. Professor Anthony Sutton, Professor Guido Preparata showed how they were pouring money into Germany through the Bank for International Settlements in Basel in Switzerland, from being completely broke to hyperinflation and poverty and the Great Depression in the 30s. Within a few years, Germany suddenly had this massive new gleaming army, massive new warships, shiny new warships of the latest cutting-edge design, big Luftwaffe of new bombers, new fighter planes, etc. Oh, excuse me. But that wasn't the only way they were supporting Hitler. I uncovered evidence that the Anglo-American Secret Intelligence Services, which you will know a lot about through your career, they worked in close unison from the turn of the 19th into the 20th century. Very close. They were always intertwined. They actually managed to put two agents directly alongside Hitler. They insinuated two agents directly at Hitler's side in the 1920s, early 1920s. One of those agents remained at Hitler's side until 1937. The other one remained at his side until 1939, when they both got out of Germany just before the war started. Now the story of the American agent probably Hans Stengel, not Hans Stenel. He pronounced Hans Stenel. And he was a Harvard graduate. He was German born in Munich, 1880 or something like that. I can't remember the exact date. To a very, very rich and wealthy German family. They've been pioneers in photography and lithographic printing and stuff like that. They made a fortune. They were very close to the German royal family, very close to the British royal family. Queen Victoria, guests at their house were Mark Twain, Joseph List, Richard Wagner, famous, world famous people. And this the son, Pootsie, he was called Pootsie because he nearly died from diphtheria when he was two. His real name was Ernest, and the old lady who looked after him called him Pootsie. Come on, Pootsie, drink, Pootsie, drink, Pootsie. And she saved his life. And Pootsie's a Bavarian term of endearment for a little fellow, a small child. And that name stuck to him. 1906, Pootsie Hans Stengel goes off to Harvard University. His mother was American, a Boston Brahmin, very elite family right through the centuries since the
revolution.
The Puritans went there, 1600s, and this guy's Pootsie's cousin, his mother's cousin, had been the long-term president of Harvard University, and Harvard was funded by Rothschild money, but particularly Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan, Kuhn Loben Bank and stuff, Jacob Schiff. And these guys were all regular guests at the Harvard president's house parties. And Pootsie was mixing this milieu. He was meeting all these guys, top Wall Street people and bankers. And he finished, while he was at Harvard, he became a friend of Theodore Roosevelt Jr., the son of the president. And Theodore Jr. took him along to the White House, and Pootsie became very friendly with the president. He was a fantastic musician, classically trained by the top musical teachers in Germany. And he would play at White House parties. And he and Theodore Roosevelt, the president, built up a very close relationship. Used to go to Oyster Bay when they were on holiday there and stuff like this. So he met all these famous, rich people at the very top of the American society. And when he left Harvard, he went off for a year to do a year service in the elite German lifeguard regiment. And then he came back to run the family art gallery on Fifth Avenue, the illustrious art gallery, fine art gallery. He now took over. He did an arts degree at Harvard, and this was him now setting up his career in America. Excuse me. So he was mixing in his art gallery with J.P. Morgan, who's coming in. J.P. Morgan's secretary who ran his library, Bell Green, they were coming in. And he was meeting all these other guys, Aleister Crowley, and a lot of these people worked for American intelligence. And Pootsie was brought into this close circle of intelligence agents. Just to cut a long story short, he was sent to Germany in 1921 as a secret agent. He was a sleeper agent for about a year when he got the call from the American embassy. We want you to meet this guy, Hitler, down in Munich. We're going to arrange for you to meet him at a beer hall tonight. Go along and say the American embassy introduced you. And he went along. He spoke to this guy, Hitler, a nobody. He'd been a previous vagabond in Vienna, and he was a minor political agitator. An oddball, basically. And Pootsie introduced himself. And the next meeting, he took his wife along. And they invited Hitler back for coffee and dinner. And the little vagabond, Hitler, previous vagabond, he went back to their house, and a very strong bond of friendship developed between him and Pootsie Hans Stengel. And Pootsie Hans Stengel was now at Hitler's side, encouraging him, grooming him for power, teaching him how to dress properly, behave in polite circles and all this stuff that Hitler had no idea about. And when he'd been at Harvard, he was a member of the kind of elite Hasty Puddings Club. I don't know if you've heard of Hasty Puddings at Harvard. It was a dramatic club. And Pootsie spent a lot of time in there. He was a great pianist. He had a good voice and he was a good actor. And he was teaching the younger students at Harvard how to express themselves with arm movements and body language. He was also the cheerleader for the Harvard football team. And he knew how to whip a crowd up into an excited frenzy. He taught Hitler all of this stuff. It was all Harvard stuff that Hitler was introduced to. Even the Sieg Heil chant came from Harvard, rah, 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 from the football team. Pootsie wrote marches for the Nazi band, stuff like that. He was with Hitler at the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923, when Hitler was injured and arrested. The first place he went to when he escaped from there, Hitler, was to Pootsie's house down in the south. Hitler was jailed for 5 years. He served 1 year to come back out. The first place he went to when he came out of prison was Pootsie Hansdale's house for Christmas dinner. Hmm. I'm just showing you how close these two were.
Yeah.
Just one last point, which was really important, was Hitler, after he'd been arrested after the putsch, he decided he was going to try and get power in Germany through the democratic process. He would try and use the vote to build up a base. It wasn't really working until the Great Depression in the 1930s. He started building up some base, but the socialists, the communists in Germany by 1932 were making big inroads into the communist vote. And that all changed when the Reichstag, the German parliament, was burned down in early 1923. And we have very strong evidence now that this American secret intelligence agent was directly involved with a false flag attack on the Reichstag. And when that happened, Hitler, he'd become the chancellor at this time with a minority. He banned the communists. He sent them all off to concentration camps and had a lot of them killed in the socialist band. And that's when Hitler seized dictatorial power. That's just one of the agents. We've got a lot in the book about a British agent who was insinuated around the same time, who did very much the same thing. It's an astonishing story. We've actually got filmmakers vying to get this story to adapt it in for film.
Sure. Yeah. It sounds like a film. I mean, it's anytime anything big happens, like a Reichstag fire or a Nord Stream pipeline getting blown up, or even a dam in the war, you know, like, people understand it is not easy to man carry explosives into a dam and blow it up. It takes a lot of resources, a lot of planning, a lot of special capacity. I'm not saying that the Americans blew that up, but it's someone who looks like the Americans. I mean, that's just the reality. And again, like, it makes no sense for them to do that, but also makes no sense for Iran, who are Shia, to fund a bunch of Sunni warriors to start a bunch of shit.
Absolutely.
You know, and so, yeah, these things get really convoluted and crazy. Yeah, I do. And when the right hand's like, oh yeah, for sure, this is going to happen, and then you come back and you talk to the right hand, they're like, we never said that. And you're like, but I heard you. I heard you say that. You know, it's
no.
It happens to somebody else. The book is called the two World Wars and Hitler. Who was responsible? Anglo-American money, foreign agents that you just heard about, and geopolitics. This book is awesome. Look how thick this thing is. You're going to learn a lot about what happened in causing these two wars and how much the competition for money and interest goes into this. And this stuff hasn't stopped. Like, we still do these things. And you can hear it, at least in American politics. For example, our Vice President Kamala Harris, when she was running, she was saying during her actual talks about trying to become a president, here is what we will have the Israelis do. Like, whoa. They're a sovereign country. You don't tell them what they have to do. But that's officially how they approach these things, you know? And that's not a, political statement. That's a statement of
no,
fact.
No, it's a
that's
statement of fact.
Right. Yeah. We approach these things this way.
It's a verifiable fact. It's a verifiable fact.
Yeah, right, 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 right. Well, and so I want everybody to go get that. Here's the link for the book, by the way, one more time. That's right there. You see it on the screen. Fellas, I might have to have you come back and let's get more into it because we kind of covered the background, but there's so much more to discuss. Anything we want to see in closing at all? I guess I'll have you go first, Johnson, on the big screen. What do you want to see in closing before you wrap this thing up? And thanks, you guys, for coming on. I really do appreciate it. It's been fascinating hearing you guys talk about this.
No, yeah, we're very pleased that you asked us because, you know, this is an important story. This is an important thing that affects both of our countries and the world. And it's sure. very good that someone like you, who has a real insight into how these things work, has taken the trouble to ask us to come on and explain what we've written in this book. And I also have to pay tribute to the immense amount of research that Jim McGregor has done. Because I was still in a job, still working when Jim was doing this. And Jim's devoted a huge amount of his retirement time after he finished being a doctor into finding out about these things. And he's done it because of it, what Jim was inspired to do this because of what he saw in Erskine Hospital when he was growing up among sure. veterans who had been damaged and destroyed by war. And that's given Jim a drive to find out the truth about these matters. And we're glad you've given us the opportunity to tell a wider audience about that.
Yes, I'll second that. Thank you, Pete. It's been really good talking to you.
Yeah. Let's have you guys come back. Let me get through some more of the books. I want to talk about some details, especially the laying in of spies. I'm still, again, I'm because I know this world, right? Here in our country, we are bad at our political class of protecting classified. It's been in the news this past month, but over and over again, like Secretary Clinton had top secret SCI on her server in her garage, and she destroyed phones. And like, this is evidence. You can't do this stuff. And so Pete, the adversarial counterintelligence agent, looks at America, he's from another country, and I go, I can break in there because they're not going to hold themselves accountable. And you guys know how badly and for how long embedded agents came into the British world. You know, yep. And we have them here. It's just there's no way around it. When we have a Chinese agent who's a chief of staff for Dianne Feinstein's, these things are crazy. And so when we talk about people embedding things, you don't have to be sensational. You just have to be someone's friend. That's right.
That's right.
Yeah. And so when you have someone right next to Hitler, you're never going to burn that person. You're just going to let them just do whatever, break whatever, whatever it is, and you just keep them right next to Hitler so that you can potentially control that puppet, possibly, right?
FDR gave him a job when he came back from Germany.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh, you guys. All right. Well, listen, thank you very much for coming on. I love it. I'm going to turn this thing off. Everybody, I will see you all tomorrow. Fellas, again, thank you very much. Stand by. I'll come back when I say goodbye to you. Everybody else.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.